papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now, you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy
a... The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis on what's going on in the media, and we have some interesting guests this week. We're going to have something of a special show. I'm Rex Smith, formerly editor of the Times Union, now with the Upstate American, which you can find on Substack, here with my colleagues. We have Judy Patrick next to me and Barbara Lombardo. Tell us who you guys are before we introduce our special guest.
Hey, I'm Judy Patrick. I'm vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association, longtime newspaper editor, and I'm here to mix it up. We got a special guest today.
Oh,
it's
cool.
Pretty exciting.
Well, I'm not the special guest, but I'll try to hold up my end of the bargain. This is Barbara Lombardo, former executive editor at the Saratogian and the Record, currently journalism adjunct at UAlbany.
Okay. Next at the end of the table is Jimmy Vielkind. Folks, if you don't know Jimmy, I've known Jimmy for many years, having hired him long ago when he was a young man. Maybe we'll talk about your resume later. But anyway, since January, he has been with New York Public Broadcasting, that is WNYC, and The Gothamist is their online presence. Previously, with The Wall Street Journal, he was the Albany Bureau Chief for Politico. He was at the Times Union before that. I'm missing something. But that's a pretty good resume, Jimmy.
Well, thank you. It's one that is now complete. Being an honored guest on The Media Project, it's a show I've listened to many, many times on WAMC, a station I've been listening to since elementary school.
The bucket list checked off at such a young age.
That's amazing. Right. But you've been covering state government for most of those years, right?
That's right. I started as a political reporter with the New York Observer the day before Election Day in 2008.
Wow.
An important election.
That's exciting.
Yes, it was. So since all of that time on New York state government, you've seen a lot that's changed. And I guess one of the things that we want to get to in this first part of the program, and then folks, we will get to other issues as well. But one of the things is how state government has changed over those years. Because in 08, of course, you had the governorship of Eliot Spitzer, I believe.
I missed him. He had resigned in March, and I got there in November. So I saw David Paterson, the former lieutenant governor who was elevated upon Eliot Spitzer's resignation, and who was governor through bad fiscal times and had a lot of struggles in his short administration.
And then after Paterson, of course, you saw the rise of, well, I shouldn't call it the rise, should I? Because that Cuomo who came along had been risen before, and this was the resurrection of Andrew Cuomo, perhaps.
It was the rise, the fall, and now we're currently doing another re-rise, potentially covering. So yes, every day of the Cuomo administration I covered, from the beginning and the quiet pre-campaigning to the campaigning to the re-elections, to the indictments, to the fights, to the other fights, to the fights, to the COVID, to the scandals, and then finally to the downfall.
One of the things I think is difficult about covering state government is that it doesn't draw the attention of people as much as, say, the federal stuff. How do you get people to pay attention to what is actually important news?
It's actually important news, and it actually touches people's lives. The federal government, of course, has massive powers to set foreign policy, whether we go to war or not as a nation, massive policy of taxation, infrastructure, transportation. But when it comes to the bread and butter issues of Americans, and in my case, New Yorkers, what your children learn in school is going to be much more deeply impacted by the state government than the federal government. Healthcare for people who are disabled or of lower income is a state-administered program in Medicaid. New York's budget is now $250 billion. It has a tremendous impact on the lives of everybody. And I think that it is of utmost importance that we shine a light and a focus on state government And it's why the Times Union has been such a wonderful newspaper for always having that focus on the Capitol, why the Daily Gazette has always worked to make sure there was somebody representing the paper on the political beat, and why readers of these publications and listeners of this station know that it's important to watch what goes on in downtown Albany.
Notwithstanding that, it's just hard to draw attention.
How has the press corps changed over the years? How many people are there? How many microphones are being held up to these politicians nowadays? And are you seeing any reverse of the trend of declining numbers at the LCA?
You know, I started again in 2008, and that was, for listeners who don't remember, the year of the financial crisis and a year of massive cutbacks for various news outlets.
Oh, we all remember that very well.
We do indeed.
And so there was a bit of a dip at that point. We did see many of the regional papers who had a dedicated presence at the Capitol. Those jobs kind of went away. The Syracuse Post-Standard, for example, had a correspondent in Albany. They haven't for some years. Other papers, even now, the New York Daily News at one point had the largest bureau. At one point was the highest circulation paper in the state of New York. If you look at the local circulation, they have nobody at the Capitol at this point. But as those regional outlets declined, you saw an increase in specialized outlets. So Politico, which I was brought on as the founding bureau chief of its Albany operation in 2013, has five or six reporters doing specialized coverage by topic area on things like health and infrastructure and energy and the environment. Also, there are outlets that have a certain ideological bent that have come into the Capitol. We've seen the Empire Center, which is a think tank that does a lot of work that could also sometimes be pushed out as journalism. And on more of the left side of the political spectrum, there's New York Focus, which has brought a new team of reporters in recent years to the state capitol. So the numbers and the headcount has actually stayed roughly steady. It's roughly 35 to 40 people. The other thing that has changed is as technology has evolved, there's less of a physical presence in the building, and there is arguably a little bit less of a need for that physical presence. Whereas in previous years, if you couldn't see it, if you weren't there, weren't in the era of everything being live streamed.
You know, I would argue that the lack of a need is because we perceive the stories differently. I was assigned to cover the Capitol in 1987, a long time ago, by a downstate newspaper, Newsday. Newsday had both a New York paper and a Long Island paper. And at the time, when I became the bureau chief, it was the largest bureau in the Capitol. We had six journalists during the legislative session. And so my job was an editor's job, and I was a national correspondent, but it was also to cover the stuff that was going on there. Here's what was different. In those days, you know, we had free roam of the Capitol. You could easily drop into a second floor, that is where the executive chamber is, a second floor office, to sit down and chat with the top aide to the governor. You could go wander into the lieutenant governor's office if you think that anything might have been going on there. Unlikely. But you could drop in and talk to the lieutenant governor. You could walk up to the fourth floor to where the fiscal staffs were for the Assembly Ways and Means Committee and find out what was going on. I think that that kind of reporting just isn't done anymore, in part because people who are in positions of authority don't make themselves available for those kinds of conversations. Isn't that right?
That's very true. There has been, particularly on the side of the legislature, and in my estimation, really since the pandemic, a dialing back of transparency and of access. There were some protests that happened before the pandemic that ruffled people's feathers. But once the public health emergency and the need for restrictions happened in 2020, they never really were fully restored. Now it's much harder to even get close to your elected leaders, to get close to the state Senate. It's unclear to me when you're allowed to go into the Senate lobby. And it's unclear that if you're wearing a tie and a jacket, you have a much better chance of getting in than if you're wearing perhaps a t-shirt with a slogan emblazoned on it. The state assembly has closed off parts of its office suite to members of the media that were previously available. And a lot of what happens and a lot of the deliberations that we as reporters are hoping to shed light on for the public happen in these intra-party conference sessions. So the Speaker of the State Assembly, and right now it's a Democrat named Carl Hastie, will brief the 100-plus members of the Democratic Conference on what's going on, and they will discuss where they stand on issues. And by talking to people after those discussions, you can find the news, find the truth, and share what is actually going on. Those discussions have actually moved to a different place in the Capitol complex, and it's been a bit more challenging to find out what's going on. And again, to point back to the pandemic, there was a time when those discussions were happening virtually.
Aha.
And so there's no door to knock on.
You can't knock on a Zoom if you don't have the access to it. And what about this dynamic? Many of us had a generation where there was divided partisan leadership in the Capitol. We in this community remember State Senate Majority Leader Joe Bruno of Rensselaer County, who was the leading Republican in the state. And then we've had some years now where the Senate has been in Republican hands, the Assembly so safely in Democratic hands, you can't imagine it ever going anywhere else, and the governorship has been a Democrat. So that surely has changed things, the dynamic of only having one party, even though, you know, Democrats don't always stand united on everything.
I always tell students and young journalists that to find out the information you need, you have to first consider who has the information, and then almost as quickly consider who has an incentive to tell you what's going on. And when you have people of opposite parties or opposite teams or differing ideologies, they have a natural incentive to say, oh man, did you hear that crazy thing that Lombardo just said? And that way, if you can confirm that it's true, you can report that as news. When you have one party, again, as you said, in the Democratic Party, I don't think it's news to say that it's not necessarily a coherent and perfectly homogenous party. But when you have differing parties, and as you did for about 50 years in New York state government, it was a little bit easier to sort of play sides off each other to find out, because there was a little bit more natural conflict.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little about the upcoming budget negotiations or the pending budget negotiations, and how do you cover that in a way that's going to be meaningful to your readers? What's your goal in covering it, and how do you report beyond a horse race of the he said, she said?
You know, my goal with budget negotiations is first to lay out the stakes. And so the initial point of a budget release is to talk about that $250 billion document, that $250 billion proposal, $252 billion, and what its major components are. And then to take the almost infinitesimal slices of the budget and explain how they would impact voters, how they would impact constituents, who is pushing for these changes, who's pushing against them, and to basically give people access points and ways that they can understand why this massive budget is going to be impactful to them. Sometimes those are fiscal programs, sometimes those are policy programs, but that has always been my strategy rather than look at the back and forth, because frankly, there's not much movement most days in the back and forth.
We mentioned earlier how healthcare is such an important issue, of course, and so how would you tackle that as a for instance to make readers, listeners care?
I would try to tackle and break down the institutional players who are invested in that healthcare discussion. So are hospitals pushing a point that angers nursing homes or that angers pharmacies? Are insurance companies and doctors battling over a certain legal provision? What does the money mean? If the money's not there, what are the impacts? What is the current status of care being provided? And how might that change with the proposal?
Now, let's hear, Jimmy, about how different life is for you. Suddenly, you've gone from working for the August Wall Street Journal, and you've been in text-based reporting for most of your career. Suddenly, you have to deal with audio because you're working for, now, a radio operation that does have a text product, Gothamist. But what's different about being a radio guy suddenly?
Well, the way that people process stories and process information with their ear creates an opportunity for a more intimate environment. You have to be concise. You have to speak more directly and clearly to readers. And you have to sort of guide them along in a way that sometimes is a little bit less in the weeds than some of the things you can do in text. Numbers don't work quite as well on radio. sentences should be shorter on radio. Anyone listening can tell I'm committing a sin every sentence I speak here right now. And so it's learning about the format, but radio has such a transformative power to bring a person and a listener to a place that with words, even the deftest writer can struggle with. So I was happy this week to publish a piece about refugees in upstate New York whose status is imperiled because of a directive issued by the State Department under President Trump, freezing funding and stopping resettlement work. To tell that story, I called people, but I also went and visited a center where orientation classes are happening and tagged along on a food delivery. And the ability to bring a news consumer, a listener, along through an audio format is very powerful. And it's a power that I'm still learning how to use and a part of the craft that I'm hoping to develop, having had more experience with the beautiful art of putting ink onto dead trees.
Yeah. He speaks pretty well, doesn't he?
He does. Well, he does a good job.
I have a face for it. I'm told I have a face for radio.
You know, we here on the Media Project have a vested interest in transparency laws. And so I would love to get your sense of where New York State stands in terms of its open government laws. And are we moving in the direction of closed government or open government?
I have really been sad to watch an erosion in the records access laws over my time at the state capitol. It seems as though when new government programs are enacted, there are specific exemptions from disclosure. Of course, the people in this room know that every public record is presumed to be public. Access is presumed unless you can prove a filing exemption. And there are many operations where statute is being constructed to exempt records from that presumption of disclosure. There have been more and more advisory panels that are claimed to be exempt from the open meetings law. That is something that I've seen as a trend and one that knocks against transparency. There has been something of a counter movement. New York's government is right now dominated by Democrats. And as Democrats attack Republicans who currently control the federal government for a lack of transparency, they understand that there is a hypocrisy argument if they don't practice what they preach. I think that in the coming months and years, that dynamic may be more at play in New York. But particularly with regard to records access, between having no clear criteria for when a request must be fulfilled, it can lead to delay, delay, delay to the point of effective death.
And so many media don't have the resources to mount those legal challenges that can open up documents or open up meetings for us or challenge the statutes that are unconstitutionally restricting or illegally restricting access to information. You know, one of the things that is interesting about your move to audio is that the only good audio reporting that is being done in America really is being done for public media. There are some podcasts where that are independent of the airwaves, but those are basically talking. When you're talking about actually reporting for audio, absent those entities that are, say, done by newspapers, New York Times Audio, for example, really it is public media, public radio, where this kind of good reporting is being done. And that is imperiled by, A, the effort in Congress to strike funding for public broadcasting, and B, it's imperiled by the lack of a real diverse audience for public media. I think there's a problem that we here who are sitting on public media channels need to appreciate is that the audience is primarily a well-educated, well-resourced audience. We're not speaking to the entire community necessarily. And I don't know quite how we do that. There's an interesting argument made in Columbia Journalism Review the other day suggesting that we need more of a return to working class media, that is something that we've lost, that American media is primarily something for the elite. Is that a fair assessment?
You know, one of the things, working in Schenectady, which is the home of radio, I would imagine. I mean, WGY was one of the first radio stations, if not the first radio station in the country. I used to go in and read their daily schedules, and they would do a lot of farm reports, and they would broadcast sermons from the local church. I mean, they were definitely a local radio station serving the public's need. I agree with you. Radio is free. You can just turn on your car radio, I guess, if it still works, if you still get an AM, and you can access important information. That's one of the things I've loved about radio. And I agree with Jimmy that it's an intimate experience. It reaches your brain in a way that maybe reading a newspaper article, which you can put away, or a TV show that you can turn away. I think radio does that in a way others do not. And I also agree that radio reaches people in rural, low-income areas that mainstream media, mainstream newspaper publications may not. And it has that opportunity. I grew up at a time when we did have quite a few AM radio stations, commercial stations that did cover the news, although they tended to be rip and read.
They were reading the news that we in the print business.
They were good readers of our stories.
mostly.
But when we were younger, not so much. I had a friend whose grandma owned a rural radio station, which had made, and she broadcast it from a room in the first floor of their house. And this radio station made its way through the countryside with the hospital report. Every morning, they would broadcast who was ready to be released from the local hospital. And think about it, these were people who out in the countryside actually didn't have any other means of contact. They actually didn't even have telephones at that time in the rural areas. And so they would say who was ready for release, and that's how the families knew who to pick up at the hospital 100 miles in town. That sort of intimacy is something that was developed, and I wonder if as audio coverage evolves, if we're going to get back to some sort of a more personalized approach to coverage than the sort of remove the voice from nowhere, as some of the critics of media coverage have called it, that's especially been prevalent in some of the higher end journalism. I hate to say it, from NPR, for example.
Well, I think that, you know, Jimmy's doing that. Well, I'm talking about the example of the story with the migrants and the training that people were getting. And so you're actually on the site you're getting their voices into the story. And one advantage of print media that can also put video and photos on, I mean, that's the best of all the worlds, because you can see it, you can hear it, you can read it. In your case, is there a game plan for expanding listenership?
One thing that was really attractive to me about this position and why I see it as such a fabulous opportunity is what you said, Rex, that the radio is free, it's available to all, it goes through the air. And as we've watched changing media consumption habits, there seems to be a trend toward reading less and less and less.
Yes.
You know, Axios, smart brevity, short, short, short. And I know that all of my 1,000-plus word features were perfect and great, and they should not.
You are a good writer.
It could not have been shortened. It could not.
Not a word.
Could not.
Spoken like
never,
a reporter.
Never. But I do think that the future will probably include more listening, and whether it goes through the magic of waves on the AM or the FM dial, whether it goes into the little supercomputers in our pockets through automatic podcast downloads, the ability to tell stories is still there. So I don't know what the future holds. It's hard to make predictions especially about the future, as a great Yankee catcher once said. But I do think that the open access model of public media, the fact that it is supported by its viewers and its listeners, is, I believe, a model that is egalitarian and, I hope, sustainable.
And I think some of that spreads by word of mouth. I'm happy to see WNYC investing in its reporting.
As am I. The New York Public News Network, which is a consortium of stations of which WNYC, WAMC, and other public media outlets around New York are members, now has three people at the Capitol. There's also WCNY's The Capitol Press Room, a great daily talk radio show that is broadcast from the Capitol Press Room. So
I'm familiar with that show. Yes, I know that one. That's who's that fine young man who does that program?
You're throwing me a softball. David Lombardo, WCNY. Jimmy Bielkind, WNYC.
Keep that straight, David Lombardo.
It works in the anagrams.
Happens to be the son of Barbara Lombardo here, if you hadn't been aware of that. And actually one of Jimmy's successors in the New Times Union Capital Bureau many years ago. How about that?
I do think, and I do hope, that you'll see even more collaboration among public media outlets in the state, and really an ability to leverage those resources, especially as some of the traditional constituents of the Capital Press Corps. We talked about the regional papers that have had to pull back, but particularly as some of those more traditional constituents do ease up on the gas, it's my hope, and it's what I will be laboring toward, to make sure that there is a broad-based mass audience, publicly spirited and publicly focused media doing reporting at the Capitol and serving the entirety of New York.
Well, it's a really valid effort and a strong concern. The rights of an independent free press, the only profession enshrined in the U.S. Constitution, defending that is certainly an act of patriotism, and supporting it is actually very valid work. So that's actually all we have time for. We'll end on that high note today. How about that? That's Jimmy Vielkind, who is here with us today from WNYC and The Gothamist. Barbara Lombardo has been here, formerly executive editor of The Saratogian and The Record of Troy. Judy Patrick, right next to me, of the Daily Gazette. I'll be okay. I'll be fine. I'll be good to get through this show without stumbling too much. And I'm Rex Smith. Thanks, folks, for joining us. Thanks to our producer, Dave Gustina. We hope to come back again next week for The Media Project.
They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian, and Jimmy Vielkind, a reporter for WNYC and The Gothamist. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.